This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The climate has gone rogue, energy prices are threatening, and the economy sucks. You know the elections aren't going to make it any better. Why wait for government? You can protect your community and yourself by helping your town withstand the shocks. This program is about the Transition Town Movement and local power. I'm Alex Smith. In our second half hour, our guest is Greg Paul, author of the new book, Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. But first, let's go straight into a great conversation about the Transition Town Movement in New England and in Europe. It was first broadcast by Sprouts Radio.
Welcome to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location each week. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, your host for Spirit in Action, broadcast via WHYS-LP in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. This is a Northern Spirit radio production, lifting up the work and lives aimed at healing the world through peace, justice, compassion, and care for creation. Today on Sprouts, we'll be sharing roughly half of an hour-long Spirit in Action interview with Rua Swenefelt and Steve Chase on the Transition Town Movement, changing our world and how we deal with the environment from the bottom up.
Let us sing this song for the healing of the world, that we may heal as one. With every voice, with every song, we will move this world along, and our lives will feel the echo of our healing.
In early July, I sat down before a live audience at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston to talk to two longtime environmental activists whose recent focus has been the Transition Town Movement. Rua Swenefelt has been a vital part of implementing the change in her Vermont town, Charlotte, with a population of about 4,000, while Steve Chase is thoroughly engaged in the same transformation, but in Keene, New Hampshire, a city of 25,000. They are also part of a new organization called Quakers in Transition. Steve Chase is Director of Advocacy for Social Justice and Sustainability at Antioch University, New England. Rua Swenefelt was the longtime secretary of Quaker Earth Care Witness.
Rua and Steve, welcome to Spirit in Action.
Thank you
so much. It's great to be here.
I'm really excited about the Quakers in Transition project. What is the motivation for this? I know both of you have environmental concerns. Why transition? What's the motivation behind this?
Well, because we need it. We're in a situation of what I consider a perfect storm of peak oil, climate change, and economic instability. They're all happening at once, and we have to do something. We could either kind of tear our hair out to go out and protest, hope that the government will make a difference, or we can take charge ourselves and do something. And that's what the Transition Town Movement is about. It's about grassroots, about people making a difference where they live. It's about transitioning gracefully away from those fossil fuels and into a different, healthier world.
Yeah, on the website for the Keene Transition Movement, the town where I'm at, the website has a tagline, which is, for local people concerned about peak oil, climate change, and a dysfunctional and unjust global economy, who want to respond with vision, courage, and creativity. And I think for some people, it's hard to even think about this. Denial is so thick, and that sometimes it can be so painful to look at our situation in the world. On the other hand, despair doesn't seem to be a very useful way for people to think about the future or get creative. And so what I think is great about this international network of community-driven initiatives that are very participatory and are trying to involve people at the local scale to move beyond sort of oil dependency and business as usual to creating thriving, resilient communities. And so if you go online and you look up peak oil, put it in Google, you're going to find a lot of people who are just so doom and gloom. You know, and there's some reasons for that. But I also think that there's so much happening around the world where people are creatively thinking through what kind of world do they want to live in and how to move there. And they don't have to wait for permission or governments to act. And I see Rua here has got what's the transition movement. If you go internationally, nationally, or local transition movement websites, they have this thing called the cheerful disclaimer. Why don't you read that?
The cheerful disclaimer is, we truly don't know if this will work. Transition is a social experiment on a massive scale. What we are convinced of is this. If we wait for the governments, it will be too little, too late. If we act as individuals, it'll be too little. But if we act as communities, it might just be enough, just in time.
You know, I'm really intrigued by one thing that both of you have said, and it's in the disclaimer, and you spoke about it, Steve. You said it's not dependent on government. And sometimes it seems amazingly difficult to find issues on which people across the political spectrum could unite on. Specifically, I'm thinking of people like the Tea Party and liberals. They don't normally find a lot of common ground. But the idea that this is doing it extra governmental seems to me like it would be a hook where people could come into unity on that. Of course, you have to be sharing in belief that there's an ecological calamity coming. And I'm not sure if there's a wide consensus on that.
One of the things that makes this successful in a community, it is nonpartisan. And it is about building resilience in a community. So you don't need to use the sustainability word, buzzword. You don't need to say peak oil. But you can say, how do we make our community resilient in the face of rising oil prices, climate catastrophes like Hurricane Irene when it came to Vermont, or economic instability, which we know exists? We can get nodding heads. I want my community to be resilient. Yes, this is something I'm willing to work on with you, even if we think the causes of those problems are different. And so you can come to the table with somebody who voted differently than you do and say, let's work together as partners.
Does it work out that way? Does it actually happen?
I think so. The one thing, it's not partisan in a political sense, but there is a question of some core values that I think are really important, because a person could agree that peak oil and the potential of energy famines are a growing and potentially catastrophic, economically catastrophic. People can agree that climate change is real, but how people respond to it also depends a lot on certain values that we hold, because one way is, oh, well, we are going to go and take over the oil supplies of other people and get very competitive. And so for Quakers and many people of faith, the idea of energy famine raises the prospect even more of resource wars and having roots in wars. And so the alternative view of what my grandmother always taught me, which is, well, you know, people have to learn to get along and they have to learn how to share. Somebody once said, the future, if there is one, will include sharing, because we could have a war of all against all. One of the things that's true for transition, and it emerged out of one of the key players, was this guy named Rob Hopkins. And he was a permaculture teacher, and permaculture has three core values. One is earth care, the second one is people care, and then the third one is fair share. It's not just that we have these severe challenges that we have to address, but how we address this depends a lot on the view of, well, do we want business as usual in terms of certain kinds of hierarchies, violence, or do we want to create local democracy, a real sense of kinship and we're in this together versus every person for themselves sort of thing. So I agree with Rua that it's nonpartisan, but it's not that it doesn't have some core values that are really important. And where this came clear to me is, so I was looking on Transition US's website, which is sort of the national hub that helps support local community. And I also was looking at the Transition Network, which is the international hub. And they described a situation that in Europe, there was a group of neo-Nazis that took the name Transition Some Community. And they were using it as a way to say, well, you know, there's going to be certain levels of austerity and we have to learn to live on less, and therefore we have to do everything in our power to keep immigrants out of. And then they had the typical racist rhetoric that neo-Nazis have. And so that made it very clear to transition movement of that we really have to articulate our values. So now, if you go to Transition US's website and you look at various constitutions, in them will be things like we support earth care, people care, fair share. We support the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And some of them say when we support the Earth Charter.
What makes the transition movement successful is that it is a leaderless movement. There are people who give us inspiration. There are books and all of that. But none of those people who wrote those are leaders. This is a shared leadership. So the purpose that I see, the reason I started it in my community, is because I wanted to broaden the reach of people knowing people, understanding the resources that we've got, how can we share those resources with each other, and how will they help us in the transition? And how can we have fun together? That's like a really core principle, is having fun. We must have fun together. You're not going to invite people in to have more long, dreary meetings about what we're going to do, but we're going to have fun together.
Is it just that we've passed peak oil? Is that the only reason that we have to get hot on the track of transition? Or is there some other timing that's really important? Why do we have to hurry so much?
We are in a situation of, I don't think of it as doom and gloom. You know, in permaculture, the solution is in the problem. The problem is the solution. So you have to fit the solution to the problem. It's kind of a joint thing. Well, of course, if there were no problems in the world, we probably wouldn't be thinking about this. But every time I get in my car, and I still own a car, I'm so aware that I am spewing CO2 into the atmosphere, that I'm helping cause more global warming, that pretty soon the parts per million of carbon dioxide in the air is not going to support the world anymore. Okay, enough doom and gloom. However, if I don't want to drive that car anymore, maybe I can help work on some local transportation that will allow me to bike to some bus close by, a little bus van that would take me to the bus that will take me to Burlington or something like that, because I live in the country. I see it as an opportunity.
So how is it actually different than being environmentally or ecologically conscious and, you know, having a program for that? How is it different from that? Is transition just the new name for the environmental movement?
In some sense, that's true in that, you know, if you look at sort of the origin story of the transition movement, it often puts it at around 2005. But there have been so many things going on and different learnings and social learnings around the world that are sort of built into this. But I think something that's, if not unique, that is rare, which is, sure, we're facing huge challenges, and not flinching from naming the challenges, but at the same time saying our response, I mean, it's good to live in challenging times. It's good to rise to the occasion. And for faith communities, the notion of right relationship that Rua was talking about, I facilitated a community conversation in Keene that had about 60 people from six different congregations, and I think we called it Climate Faith and Action. But there was a core concern that was pretty clear that I just sort of tried to articulate. Is I asked people in the room, how many people in your deepest heart of hearts want to live in a world that's spiritually fulfilling, socially just, and environmentally sustainable? And everybody's hands went up. And it's not just a mistake. It has so much to do with the roots of our faith tradition. If you look at page 2 of George Fox's journal, who's the founder of Quakerism, he talks about the three main kinds of loving that Judaism and Christianity have always taught and that are really important to Quakers. One is loving God with all one's heart and soul and strength. And that, I think, is one way to talk about spiritual fulfillment. Talks about loving your neighbors, including your enemies. And I think that has to do with social justice. And then written in the 1600s, it was saying we have to love God's good earth and act in unity with creation. So I think these concerns are really deep in many people's heart, and certainly deep in faith traditions. And these kinds of pressures and challenges allows us to give up complacency, to give up conformity and get creative with our neighbors. And some examples of people doing things, even though they would disagree about whether gay marriage ought to be in place, even if they would disagree about who you would vote for, is in Keene, where we just about 3 weeks ago had a groundbreaking for a new food co-op. And it already has 1,000 members in a town that's 25,000 people. It has a strong commitment to buying locally because over the last 10 years, we've gotten, I think, close to 20 community-supported agricultures right around our area. We now have a farmer's market. We now have a winter's farmer's market. And part of transition is just thinking, well, what's kind of the next cool thing that we could do that would shift us to sort of responsible, safe and green energy sources? And here's where it's different from a lot of environmentalists. With the sort of recognition we're going to have to learn to live well on less, that all the alternatives, if you sort of do the math, and there's some dispute about this, but there's a really good chance that we're not going to have as ready a supply of cheap and abundant energy. All the stuff around local food in our committees, and that's really strong where Rui is in Vermont, is reducing food miles, reducing the inputs in terms of pesticides, which are petroleum-based, and fertilizers, petroleum-based, and the machinery. And so cutting down the food miles and creating that resilience, because I think the statistic is in a lot of major cities, if there weren't imports of food, there would be about 3 to 5 days supply before the people living in cities. And this is true of small towns. If the shelves of the supermarket wouldn't fill. And so having increasing the percentage that you're producing locally or regionally allows you to absorb the shocks that may be coming. And ecologically, resilience is this capacity of a system to absorb shocks and keep its fundamental integrity together. And so I do think you're right that a lot of people who might disagree about all sorts of things love their town and would love to be, you know, engage as a volunteer and have public life and the joy of it. And that's one of the real positives, is seeing just the excitement of people thinking, what next?
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're listening to a report on the transition town movement in New England, prepared by Mark Helpsmeet of Northern Spirit Radio.
Today we're looking at the transition town movement with Steve Chase, Social Justice and Sustainability Advocacy Director at Antioch University New England, and with Rua Swennerfelt, perennial force behind Quaker Earth Care Witness, and with the Charlotte, Vermont transition town implementation. So over to you, Rua. Just how does one go about becoming a transition town? What do you do, and is it applicable to absolutely any city or town?
I think the transition model is totally adaptable. I went to Europe last year, and I went to 10 different countries and visited transition communities. I also went to the Transition France conference and a Transition UK conference. And everybody I interviewed, everybody I talked to, they did things a little differently in their community. They had the same core principles and beliefs. They had the transition handbook. They didn't do the steps in exactly the same order. They didn't do all the steps. They added some steps depending on where they live and what kind of culture they had, and were they urban, were they suburban, were they rural. There was Transition Paris, and you go, well, how can Paris be a neighborhood? Well, what they did was they broke down into smaller units that were each transition communities, and then they had a hub. So Paris was a hub, same in Transition Barcelona. I visited Transition Los Angeles. They do the same thing. So, you know, there are lots of physical manifestations of what people do. You know, we're talking a lot of words here. Well, what do they do? So an example, one transition community in England, they had their members during the summer stealthily going through neighborhoods and looking for where pear trees and apple trees and those sorts of things were, and they wrote down the addresses. And then when it was time for harvest, they went and rang the doorbell and said, "We see that you've got a pear tree, you know, in your yard. If you're not going to collect all of it, we'd be happy to harvest the tree, give you what you want, and then we want to give the rest away to people in need." And I was like, wow, this is like kind of ultimate gleaning, right? You're helping the people that have the tree. And how many people have trees in their yards where the fruit falls and never gets eaten? What a waste. In our community, we have an asset directory. There's a survey. Anybody in the community can answer the survey. It talks about what kind of skills and resources you have that you're willing to share with others. And then other people can say, well, you know, I'd love to have this skill. So the asset survey combines those things. It's up on our website. And anybody, if I want to learn how to can or compost or scythe or sharpen tools, or there wasn't a necessary model for that. We just thought this would be good. And then we share it with others and others can do it. I think it's that adaptability that it's not prescribed.
Where do people look if they want to know what these principles and guidelines are?
I think it's important to realize that social movements are different than sort of corporate franchises. And it's not like you buy a license to be a transition town. If it inspires you, the basic ideas, and a bunch of people get together and let's say, let's try to do it. At the same time, it is a network of about 1,000 communities now that are formal transition initiatives around the world. There are networks, there's training, and so there's a concern about quality control. There's also, you know, trainings and workshops on how to deal with difficult people. Let's face it, we're a cussed species, and sometimes the culture doesn't help us really think well about how to work with other people. And that's why transition often talks about, well, we need an outer transition of our community. We need to relocalize our economies. We need to have an energy descent plan and figure out how we're going to use forms of energy that aren't damaging the way fossil fuels are, and also learn to live on less. So those are some core concerns with the ethical things. And the basic thing is that, you know, that may be enough to sort of guide people as they work it out in their community. One of the things I like that Rob Hopkins, who wrote the Transition Handbook in 2008, he subscribes to what he calls the theory of anyway. And the theory of anyway goes, we'll say climate change doesn't turn out to be quite as serious as we thought. And say it turns out alternative energy sources are going to be just as abundant and maybe more abundant. Do you really going to feel so terrible and really bad that, oh, now we have more local democracy and now, you know, kids know how to grow food and are more self-reliant and, oh, you know, I learned how to make a cob house. My life has been ruined because of that. So part of it is that these are skills of a decent culture and life anyway. So the sense of urgency, I think, is there, but it is also appealing to people about a sense of being connected to the land and to each other.
You asked about, well, how do you get started? Well, you can go to transitionnetwork.org, which is international, transitionus.org, which is national. And then you can go to quakersintransition.wordpress.com and find some networking of friends that are involved in this. You can buy the Transition Handbook, first published, then Transition Companion, which just was released this last year. And there are some other books. The Transition Timeline is another. If you are interested, you can get on the Transition US website and look for trainings, trainers. Steve is about to go get trained to be a trainer. And so we're going to have, like in New England, probably 12 trainers that would be available to do these weekends. You will find them and you'll be able to organize in your community such a training. After that, at some point, a new training now is called Transition Thrive, which is you've got your group, you've been at it for a few years. How do you go deeper? How do you go to the next level? When I visited transition communities like in Scotland, they actually were incorporated. They were doing community business. They had community bakeries. They raised the money in the community. There's actually a wonderful book called The Town That Food Saved. It's about Hardwick, Vermont, and the very creative ways that they used community funding and federal and state funding to start things that were important for that community. So they're actually in England and in Scotland, they are moving forward in that way. That's kind of this thrive. What do we do? And the thing about governments, in a community, it's very important to partner with your town or city government. So in my community, a couple of us made an appointment, went and talked to our select board about what we were doing. We're already partnering with the Conservation Commission and the Energy Committee in the town. But we wanted to partner with the select board. And all of a sudden they said, we've got two projects for you right now, you know. And it was one about too many parents are driving their kids to school and everybody's paying for school buses. And it causes a huge traffic jam at the central school. And what can you do about that? And the other one was help us get a recycling center that would come like once a month, you know, a transfer station kind of roving thing. And could you do that? And we were like, yes. So they gave us some real practical things to do, and they were delighted that we were willing to tackle it. So our first task is going to be, how do we make riding the bus really cool? So that kids say to the parent, no, no, don't drive me. I want to get on the bus. So
good luck on that one. Yeah, good luck, yeah.
Yeah, right.
The other thing, you brought up government, and you had mentioned that before, Mark, that I think there's a distinction to be made between if we wait for government, it won't happen fast enough. But that's different than saying there is no role for government in making things better. Certainly at the level of international treaties, certain national policies could help facilitate this. And so it's not an anti-government stance per se. It's just sort of we're ultimately responsible. And we can wait around for other people to do it for us. But let's just get going at the scale we can do. And that would likely, as that mushrooms and more communities are doing this and engaging in this process, it likely will capture the attention. And certainly in places where it's more advanced, it has. In Keene, one of the things we have is just an awareness building is that we have something called Transition Tuesdays. And so we have community conversations once a month or maybe some films. And we had this great film called A Convenient Truth, which is about Curitiba, Brazil, which has done some amazing things around recycling, around public transportation, affordable housing, encouraging entrepreneurship for small businesses. So what we did is we showed that movie, and because we feel that people need to see as much or more a sense of what's possible, what people are already doing, than the dire consequences if we don't do something. So we showed that, but then we brought in somebody from the city council, we brought in the city planner, and we brought somebody in from the county conservation district to talk about the ways that city and county government are already engaged in the same concerns that the transition movement has and seeing themselves as partner and telling great stories. And some of it was just simple about, you know, the solar panels on our city hall. But the city planner said, you know, once you start thinking like this about where can we find creative things, everything starts looking like an opportunity. And so he described how in the water treatment plant, water rushes in. And then all of a sudden they realized that rushing water is untapped energy. And so they put, you know, these little micro turbines that come in, and now the entire water treatment plant is off the grid. The water going into it that needs to be treated powers the whole thing.
Just a few of many possible examples of transition town thinking being implemented in the U.S. and around the world, shared thanks to Steve Chase and Rua Swinnerfelt, both active in transition town work in their respective locales of Keene, New Hampshire and Charlotte, Vermont, with both of them involved together in Quakers in Transition. That's it for Sprouts today, but you can hear the full Spirit in Action interview with Steve and Rua, including another half hour of thought, inspiration, and action related to the Transition Town movement at northernspiritradio.org. Just search for Transition Town on the site. Again, that's northernspiritradio.org. You also heard the theme music for Spirit in Action, Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson.
That was a report about the best solution I see out there in these troubled times, the Transition Town Movement. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock as we investigate bringing local energy to your community.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We all worry about future energy supplies and the climate cost of what we've got right now. We have to choose between big utility mega projects or toss some solar panels on the roof, right? Wrong, according to Greg Paul, the author of a new book, Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. It's part of the Post Carbon Institute's Community Resilience Series with a foreword by Van Jones. Greg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you today.
What is a local energy project? Can you give us a couple of examples?
Sure. One that immediately comes to mind is the Ellensburg Community Solar Project in Ellensburg, Washington, which was one of the first of its kind in the nation. It came online in 2006 after about 3 years of collaborative effort on the part of the municipal utility, the Washington University Extension Service, and also local citizens who all participated to make this 150-kilowatt solar electric project a reality. Another example would be the Fox Islands Wind Project in Vinyl Haven, Maine. This project was first conceived in 2001, and after a lot of hard work by the Fox Islands Electric Cooperative, a number of other area organizations, and the island residents as well, the $14 million three-turbine 4.5 megawatt project was completed in 2009. There's another very different example, which is the Harney District Hospital Pellet Heating Plant in Burns, Oregon, where the hospital was planning a new building back in 2005. They decided to include a new 500,000 BTU pellet-fired boiler to replace a previous system that relied on propane for fuel, and it was the first of its kind in the state, and has not only worked better than expected, but has also reduced the hospital's heating costs substantially.
Well, those sound pretty exciting for me. We don't tend to think about energy in political terms, but you do encourage us to include politics. In your mind, what is the difference between a democratic energy system from one that is undemocratic?
Well, a democratic energy system is one that is owned by the people whom it serves, not by some distant corporation. This could be a small local energy project, like a community solar project that I mentioned just now, or perhaps a much larger organization, like a public utility district, which is very popular on the west coast of the United States.
And you focus on these local projects over large centralized energy. Why do you feel the local angle is so important?
It's about the local economy, basically. Local energy projects keep your energy dollars circulating in the local economy rather than exporting it out of state or even out of country in some cases. And that local money circulating in your local economy creates what's known as the multiplier effect. And so that money gets re-spent over and over again in the local economy. It's all about strengthening the local economy.
On the other side, big government seems stalled or even hostile to local power. Do we need them at all?
Well, yes, ideally. But some progress is better than no progress at all. And I'm afraid that if we wait around for the federal government, especially Congress, to lead on these issues, not much is going to happen. So, sure, if the federal government would play a cooperative role in all of this, it certainly would make things easier and we would get there faster. But, again, you don't have to wait around for Congress for your local community to get involved in a project of its own.
Greg Paul, 6 years ago you wrote the Citizen-Powered Energy Handbook. What has changed since then?
That's a good question. I think probably local attitudes have certainly changed about that, and a lot of rules and regulations that used to be barriers are beginning to change as well. In addition, more communities and local groups are frustrated by the lack of progress at the national level and have decided to take matters into their own hands. They're also seeing the progress made in other communities and want to follow these early examples with projects of their own. So I think that those are the major differences.
Well, and I guess, too, some of the sources of alternative energy have become cheaper, like solar panels, for example.
Yes, dramatically.
Well, let's say I'm living in a condo or I'm renting. I've got no way to add renewable energy personally. How can I still participate in providing local energy?
Well, actually, I do mention one example of a family who managed to convince their condo association in Chicago to let them install a solar array on the roof of the condo. But admittedly, that's generally not an easy thing to do because of the complexity of condo association rules and regulations. So for most people, the best way for condo or apartment dwellers to participate is to try to locate a community solar or other group renewable project in their area that they can perhaps either invest in or perhaps participate in as subscribers. There are a number of different models that I describe in the book that would work in that kind of a situation.
And when we're thinking about our personal energy use, you suggest that sometimes the best move can actually be to move. When does buying a new home make the greatest energy sense?
Another good question. I guess it depends on a number of different situations. If a move meets a number of needs at the same time, but especially if it avoids a long commute from a distant suburb, it can make a lot of sense. Also, if you are perhaps a family with an empty nest, so to speak, your kids are gone, you're looking to perhaps downsize to a smaller home, that might be an obvious time to consider relocating. But when you make that decision to relocate, you need to keep in mind the idea of reducing commuting as much as possible. That's really the main thing.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with local energy expert Greg Paul. Greg, a growing number of community wind projects around the United States are community in name only. They bring little benefit to the localities in which they're sited. How could such projects be truly community-based, and would that make them more popular?
Yes, it's mostly a matter of ownership. If the community is proposing its own project that will directly benefit the local residents, most people will support it over another project that's owned by some out-of-state corporation that will siphon off most of the energy and probably most of the project benefits as well. The big commercial wind farms tend to be enormous in size and scale, which certainly raises a lot of legitimate issues for many local people. And most community wind projects tend to be much smaller in size and scale. Instead of involving perhaps hundreds of turbines, it might just involve two or three. The Fox Island wind farm I mentioned earlier is a good example of just three commercial-scale turbines instead of, you know, 30 or perhaps 100. So even though the community projects are smaller, because the ownership stays local, virtually all of the benefits go to the local community, and that makes a huge difference. And the other thing is that if you get the community involved in their own project, out of necessity, you involve the local community in all of the early planning and all the discussions, and the problems that do come up are normally solved at the local level, and people are generally the best judges of what's right for their own communities.
Are those community-based projects, like those three wind turbines, are they still tied into the grid in such a way that if you have a big blackout throughout the whole grid, do you lose community power then too?
In general, most of these community projects are tied into the grid, and in general, if the entire grid goes down, you would have to isolate that power from that project until the grid was brought back up. But yes, these systems can be set up so that the community could benefit immediately in that kind of a situation.
Moving to hydroelectricity, most people picture rivers and big dams, but not all projects need those dams. How could cities near rivers generate hydroelectricity without a dam?
Yes, it is possible. It depends a little bit on the particular situation, but in some locations, it's certainly possible to generate electricity with a so-called run-of-river strategy that does not involve a dam. In this case, there is an inlet upstream for the water to be temporarily borrowed for the hydro project. Runs through a pipe, goes into the generator, the turbine generator, and exits at the other end out what's called a tail race. This really doesn't really back up the river. It doesn't really affect river flow substantially. It doesn't involve any silting, which is a big problem with large dams. And so there's a very, very low impact of that type of project. And there are quite a few of those that are either in existence already in many locations or are being planned. It's a real low-impact way of generating hydroelectricity, and it's definitely a very renewable strategy.
You're not a fan of hydrogen in the alternative energy mix. Why is that?
I guess the simplest answer is that hydrogen is basically a net energy loser. Supplies of pure hydrogen don't really exist, so it has to be extracted from other sources, such as water. And in that process, you use a lot of electricity. And the conversion process always involves energy loss. The lack of any meaningful national hydrogen infrastructure is another major problem. It would take many, many years and billions of dollars to create that infrastructure, and that money could be better spent on other local energy projects that have a proven track record. I'm not saying that hydrogen has no future at all, but I think it's generally limited, and there are a lot of people who I think have unrealistic expectations about it.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking with Greg Paul, author of the new handbook, Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. You warn the replacement of fossil fuel-based energy sources with renewables cannot meet our current energy use, especially with transportation. What is a realistic picture of our lifestyles 2 decades in the future? How will we get around? How will we heat our homes? And what would we have to perhaps live without?
Excellent question. And the transportation sector is the big one. We are just so totally dependent on fossil fuels for transportation. I guess the most realistic answer is that we will probably be traveling a lot less. People will tend to live closer to their work, which certainly is in line with my suggestion earlier about actually moving as a strategy to reduce your energy use. We will probably be using a lot more biomass and solar heating for heating our homes. Our homes are very vulnerable in terms of heating to fossil fuels, because we tend to rely on fossil fuels or electricity for home heating. And there aren't a lot of real easy substitutes for that. We'll probably be living with a lot less unnecessary stuff and focusing more on essentials.
Since the 2008 recession, finding financing for projects has been pretty challenging. How are communities interested in energy projects faring? What are some of the options beyond banks?
Well, actually, local banks are a good place to start looking. Local banks certainly have the best interests of their own communities in mind, and they tend to loan most of their money out for local projects. So even though it might not be the first place that you would think to look, it probably is one of the best for a local project. I was involved in a local solar energy project here in Vermont, and we got part of our financing from a local bank that was just quite happy to make that loan. There are a large number of alternative sources for project financing, but they tend to vary from state to state, and so you have to check to see what's available in your particular state. But in general, if the project is well conceived and properly financed, financing is available for most of these projects. Some projects are self-financed by the participants, and new crowdfunding should be available next year once the Securities and Exchange Commission implements new rules governing this type of funding that was included in the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, the Jobs Act, signed by President Obama back in April. So there's a number of alternative sources of funding.
In Europe, feed-in tariffs, called FITs, have been an important part of funding renewable energy initiatives. What are FITs, and how could their wider use in North America encourage sustainable energy development?
A feed-in tariff is a policy mechanism designed to encourage investment in renewable energy technologies that generate electricity. FITs provide a guaranteed price and access to the grid that gives renewable energy projects the solid foundation that they need to attract investors and also to be able to make long-range plans. A feed-in tariff offers the promise of a model in which almost anyone can become a renewable energy investor and owner, and they're becoming increasingly used in different states around the country and even in municipalities, and they definitely have provided a real boost to renewable energy projects where they've been implemented.
Greg Paul, suppose our community wants to organize a local energy project. Do we still have to go through all the hoops, the expensive review processes and permits that the big coal, oil, and gas plants do?
Well, although there are some differences, the general regulatory and approval process is similar. A lot of federal, state, and local rules and regulations need to be changed or simplified to make it easier for small community projects that have strong local support. Now, in some cases, exemptions might make sense. And in other cases, a simplified process specifically designed for small local projects would be extremely helpful. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has oversight of hydro projects across the nation. And they've recently made some changes that have definitely sped up the process for approval, and I've cited one good example in the book. The regulatory and approval process at all levels has evolved over many years to reflect the large, centralized, corporate-dominated energy infrastructure of the 20th century. And it's going to take time to change that emphasis to reflect the new, more local realities of the 21st century.
Do you see local energy fitting in with the transition town movement?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Transition towns movement emphasizes relying on local resources for food, energy, money, and most of the other necessities of life. So, yes, it's an ideal fit.
Greg, I'm worried we may not have enough time to get local energy going, especially with the rules we just talked about, before the financial system dries up or crashes or before the weather disruption gets really bad. What has been the time lag between visioning a local project and getting that power or heat online in the community?
Well, it varies from community to community and from project to project, but I would say that it normally takes a few years to get a project organized and the legal, technical, and financial details worked out. In a local community solar project that I mentioned previously that I participated in here in Vermont, it took us 18 months to get it all lined up and only 39 days to build the thing.
Wow. Do you have a website for this new book or a place where we can find out more?
Yes, www.gregpahl.com, GREGPAHL.com.
Thank you. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We've been listening to Greg Pahl, author of a new book that helps individuals and communities develop their own local sources of energy. And that's what the world needs, in my opinion. The title is Power from the People, How to Organize, Finance, and Launch Local Energy Projects. It's from Chelsea Green Publishing and part of the Post Carbon Institute's Community Resilience series. Look for it in your local bookstore or order it online from all the usual sources. Greg, thank you for writing this useful book.
Well, thank you so much for letting me tell you about it today.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We started out this program with information on how to turn your community into a transition town, with examples from New England. Next week, we'll find out how this transition movement transcends many different political views. The famous alternative thinker Albert Bates joins us from the farm in Tennessee. Albert tells me transition can succeed in a red state, thick with Republican voters, even in a very rural community. We'll find out how. As you know, the transition movement started out in the UK with Rob Hopkins and his community. If you have local experiences you would like to share, be sure and send me an email with a short description of what is going on around you. We can pass that on to listeners, or perhaps you can be a guest on Radio EcoShock, sharing what works. Maybe you would like to suggest someone I should call as a guest. There are two ways to get in touch. Email me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org, radio@ecoshock.org, or go to our website at ecoshock.org and click on the contact button to send me your message. When it comes to transition, we all have a role to play and a voice to speak with. I appreciate hearing from you. We have a little time left to pass on this gem from another in my list of must-listen radio. This is from The Truth About Markets radio program broadcast from Resonance FM in London. Co-hosts Max Kaiser and Tracy Herbert have been warning for years the banking and corporate system are corrupt. They pretty well coined the term banksters back in the day when people still trusted banks and the markets. In this 5-minute clip, Max, who worked for years in the markets and designed sophisticated trading software, and Tracy talk about new studies on one law for the rich and another for you and I.
Yo, time for Truth About Markets with Max and Stacy.
Study shows, this is actually the first time this has been studied and with actual real numbers and looking at the cost-benefit analysis. Studies show CEOs are not subject to same rule of law as you. Recent academic papers begin the formal work of proving that CEOs and giant corporations face a completely different legal system than the rest of us, one in which their vast resources are used to ensure that they can safely ignore laws and rules applicable to small fry. One study looked at the influence of corporate lobbying on fraud detection, and it's called Corporate Lobbying and Fraud Detection, issue 46 of the Journal of Financial and Quantitative Analysis by Frank Yu of Barclays Global Investors and Zhuyan Yu of Indiana University. What they found was that firms' lobbying activities make a significant difference in fraud detection. Compared to non-lobbying firms, firms that lobby on average have a significantly lower hazard rate of being detected for fraud, evade fraud detection 117 days longer, and are 38% less likely to be detected by regulators. In addition, fraudulent firms on average spend 77% more on lobbying than non-fraudulent firms, and spend 29% more on lobbying during their fraudulent periods than during their non-fraudulent periods. The delay in detection leads to a greater distortion in resource allocation during fraudulent periods. It also allows managers to sell more of their shares. So there's actually a direct statistical analysis you can do of how much less likely they are to be prosecuted by just bribing regulators and bribing politicians.
Sure, and they'll take that statistic and they'll turn it into a collateralized futures contract, trade it on the exchange, and make more money. So it's fraud within fraud within fraud. You know, the average, you know, like the trend of the global economy for individual wealth is down because the population is rising. You know, 7 billion people on planet Earth are sharing roughly the same amount of resources that we had 50 years ago. And those resources are shrinking because of all the stresses and strain of having 7 billion people on planet Earth. So the average, you know, wealth is for the 7 billion people on Earth is shrinking. Their wealth in terms of access to clean water, clean air, arable land, and a kind of a mental space that comes with having some open space is shrinking. It's shrinking rapidly. So the average person's wealth is shrinking. The only way to overcome this shrinkage is by committing fraud. You have to commit fraud, and this is what's being done. There's the only way to do it. Now, anyone who doesn't commit fraud is being foolish, because there's no legitimate way that you can economically flourish in this global economy anymore. There's simply no more resources. So there's only fraud. There's only fraud that's left.
So they point to, for example, the Keating Five, the five senators who intervened in a criminal investigation and stopped it. They demanded an investigation into Lincoln Savings and Loan stop. And of course, if they found out that they were lobbied. But this study shows that this hideous perversion never stopped and not only includes direct campaign contributions, but also lobbying. They show that firms increase their lobbying expenses after they commit fraud. So remember the increase in lobbying by all the banks since 2008. These are the kickbacks they're giving directly and openly to avoid these prosecutions. So no wonder Goldman Sachs, look at their lobbying contributions, see how much they paid to avoid this prosecution. During the time that they are committing fraud, executives of lobbying firms sell their stock about four times more than firms that aren't lobbying. Then there's another study by Florida State University, and they find that accused executives whose firms have contributed to political campaigns via a PAC are banned as an officer for three fewer years than those at non-bribe-paying firms, serve probation for five fewer years on average than a non-bribe-paying firm, and prison for six fewer years, and are 75% less likely to be given both prison time and an officer ban, which is the most severe form of criminal and civil penalties. So huge drop in not only punishment but in fines for those who have paid bribes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, so it's all quantifiable. It's all broken down. It's all charting out. And you would think that that would be the basis for some criminal prosecutions, but instead it's being used by the other side, the bankers, to make markets in fraud. That will just make it easier for them to make markets, make money trading in fraud, and that's what they use all the data for.
That was Max Kaiser and Tracy Herbert from the August 11th Truth About Markets show on Resonance FM in London. Their website is maxkaiser.com. Use the search box on the homepage to search for Truth About Markets and listen to their programs or download them. By the way, Max Kaiser and Tracy are one of the few finance experts who also warn us about climate change rather than trying to deny it. It's refreshing. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. The website is ecoshock.org, or look for each week's show blog with all of the links at ecoshock.info. We'll go out with this classic by Peter Gabriel. Something in the words and melody struck a chord in my heart this week. Look after one another, won't you? And thanks for caring about your world.
Your eyes
of all the